Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the launch of Jack and Woman by Jane Bennett and Chandi Herrera. Shemaine's not here tonight, but Jane's going to be in conversation with Divine and Pumla. Okay, we're in the company of a number of greats tonight, including those in the audience. I've seen some good-looking people, but in the mind way. Anyway, I've been lectured by both Jane and Divine, so I can assure you that's going to be a fascinating chat, not by Pumla, but I know from your CV that we're going to have a good discussion. Jane is the director of the School of African and Gender Studies, Anthropology and Linguistics, and the director of the African Gender Institute at UCT. Charmaine, who's not here, is a coordinator of the Initiative for Women's Studies in Nigeria and the author of multiple books, three people tonight. As far as I can tell, Pumla still teaches African continental and diasporic literature at WITS. Yes?
Yes.
And is also extremely well known for the work on her work on gender and sexuality. And lastly, we have Almail. Divine lectures in social anthropology at UCT, as well as being associate researcher at Center for African Studies at
Basel.
Thank you. So, as you can see, we have a panel of incredibly intellectual people. I apologize for condensing you guys so much into your academic selves, but there are quite a few of you. Jacketed Woman is a book with an enormous scope, and very interestingly, I think, from a very particular female perspective, which I find rather intriguing. It's centered towards academia, but it's incredibly accessible. And as a gender studies student and an anthropology student, I find it incredibly useful. I've been lucky enough to get a copy myself. It's casual, but very clear. And I think it focuses a lot on human relations, even though it is centered, obviously, around gender and sexuality. It's also interspersed with beautiful portraits by Zanele Mutlole. And yeah, I think that kind of gives a very personal aspect to the book. Last few things from me, the bar is going to be closed during the duration of the talk, but you can get you some water. We're going to have some questions after they speak. And I just want to hand over to Sandy quickly to say a few words.
Thanks, Claire. Good evening, everyone. I'm Sandy Shepherd. I'm the publisher for UCT Press and the proud publisher of this very important book, highlighting research methodologies around a very topical area of work, gender and sexuality. The book I started talking to Jane about in 2010, but she and Charmaine before that had embarked on a long process of putting this together, working with established and emerging researchers. Jane told me that her work involves developing projects in which she can maximize the ideas and creativity about what it means to live in marginalized spaces. And she said she's interested in going to the underbelly of subversive or difficult spaces. And that's certainly what this book does. Thank you, Jane, for arranging for Professor Pola and Dr. Fu to be here after this wonderful discussion. Professor Pola, you know, as a well-respected academic, but also frequently visible as a commentator on public culture. I particularly enjoyed your column in City Press, pouring acid on the white suit of that sushi king, Kenny Kunene. And Dr. Fu, I know you've presented on research methods in social sciences, and so I look forward to hearing what you have to say on this book too. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming here this evening. Thanks to the Book Lounge for hosting this and for your continued support at UCT Press's Outposts. Enjoy the evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jane, for the invitation. I also want to thank Mark. You cannot hear. Sorry. Oh, okay.
I think it's on.
I thought it's on.
Yes, it's on.
Okay. Thank you again, Jane, for this invitation. And I also want to thank the Book Lounge for the opportunity to also speak on the launch of this book. When Jane sent me an email some weeks ago, I thought that it's very difficult to say no to Jane. And I had no choice but to accept. But weeks into having to read that book, I've seen the difficulties of what it means to read a book and speak on the book at a book launch. But
sorry, you still cannot hear in the back. I'm very sorry.
It's fine, I'll go off. You can take it up.
Okay. But when I started reading the book, I was fascinated by the title and also the cover, Jacket Women. It reminded me that the first time I understood that the term jacket actually meant something to cover yourself was when I moved to Europe. Because where I came from, a jacket had another name, it's called a frisson. So jacketed women posed lots of questions. I wanted to understand what this jacket was, what it really meant, how it came about, this term, and who were the people who were going to wear this jacket, and what it represented. So, as I was reading through the chapters, my primary or secondary school history teacher came into my mind. I recalled years back in secondary school, he had told me that facts were stubborn things. Building on one of the U.S. Presidents, John Adams, he has told us that facts are things which tend to challenge people. And when we deal with facts, quite often we tend to interpret facts or use them in such a way that they will suit our own needs. And this book, for me, deals with that issue. How do we engage with stubborn facts? How do we engage with facts about researchers, and how do we engage with facts about sexuality? Sexuality in context, especially in African context, where women are constructed as people who have to be saved or theorized as people who are continuously being victimized. From the first page of that book and through the chapters from Pereira's introduction with Jane, they try to engage with this complexity and also the kinds of options which are open to especially women, who most of whom or all of whom have written this book, the kinds of complexities and problems which they engage with when they conduct research on sexuality and gender. And it was fascinating to understand the kinds of identity crisis which women face. Problems about constructing them as good women and also as bad women. At the same time, problems about accepting them in communities, but also dealing with constructions of women, theorized with by frameworks of theories, which one of your authors, Awino, says Western theorists, which often seem not to fully understand a local context. So through the book, what Jane and Pereira and all the others have done is to look at first the material conditions of what it means to be a researcher, especially a female researcher, conducting research on questions which are sometimes silent, you know, in areas where some of these issues are also considered taboo. And also I think what the book has enabled is ways to continue doing qualitative research on women without necessarily imposing deductive ideas upon them. So I found this book very fascinating in these various directions. But also because my history professor in secondary school had told me that because facts are stubborn things, they are also very political. And this is an issue which Jane and Pereira with the authors in the book try to engage with the political context and the political nature of research. And I was very happy to find out that the researcher is in themselves a politician who have to play different kinds of politics to negotiate both ideas and to negotiate their bodies and the ways in which they collect the kind of data which they collect. So part of what I think most of the researchers face is how to deal with the contamination that the body, which is the instrument of data collection, already faces before it inserts itself into the field. You know, how do we decontaminate this body? And how do we also decontaminate these areas? And when you enter the field with a political project, how do you separate yourself from being a politician and at the same time
researcher. So the key issue for me is how to produce facts about women without necessarily presenting them in ways that do not represent them in the areas where they live. The introductory chapter actually really sets a very good foundation for this book. It raises lots of key questions, questions arising from how to deal with your identity as a researcher, how to deal with literature, for example. It also engages with the questions of jackets, and that as researchers, we are constantly wearing and giving off jackets. So how do we negotiate this multiplicity of jackets when we enter the field? The question is, what happens to people in places where they are not jackets, where they wear more hats and other stuff? And part one important question which seems to arise in the book is also questions of translation. You know, as researchers, we are translators. How do we translate? You know, how do we prepare ourselves to translate? And what languages do we represent people, the kinds of women that we study? So in my view, this book tends to add on to a whole host of books and research which has been written by people such as Amina Mama, Ifeoma Ajime, and issues about interrogating gender and research in the continent, and also how to use qualitative research in such a way that we can enable new ways of rethinking gender, and particularly African women.
Good evening. I'm going to try and use the mic, but I'm very loud, so I'll probably put it away at some point. First of all, congratulations, Jane. I'm very excited about this book. And I'm very excited about this book taking on a public life. Because, of course, I'm sure that for you and Charmaine and for your contributors, it's entering another stage of its life. It's had other lives and formation. I haven't read all of the book, but I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it. I've read bits of it, and I am very excited by what I think it's a remarkable feat. You know, we all have to, those of us who choose to be located in the academy, have to deal with questions of research methodology all the time. But my God, our books on research methodology, dull. you know, we have to do it because we have to think about it, and we have, you know, but very often it is the least exciting area to read in. I mean, it's important, we can't ignore it. So it's so wonderful to have jacketed women in hand, because in many respects it does all of the difficult, important information work of that a serious and rigorous collection of reflections and new directions in research methodology do. But it is also so many other things that are, I think, usually not associated with that field. It is such a beautiful book. In more than one sense, and I'll say a little bit about that. So I'm just excited about how beautiful this book is, both in terms of the text but also visually, as well as the various ways and the various ways in which both the images in the book and the text produce knowledge and suggest certain ways of reading and doing work and uncovering work and so on. And I think this is, well, I know, I suspect, I should say, but I think I know. I suspect that this is not a coincidence. I suspect that the beauty and the various layers of languages that this book uses to speak about knowledge production and how we produce knowledge and the dangers and the joys and the pleasures of these specific methodologies are not accidental. They are, in fact, you know, very consistent with the work of the, you know, of the scholars who edit this book. The attention to the way in which aesthetics and knowledge production intersect in various ways, the attention to the way in which the attention and the return in much African feminist scholarship to the insistence that the visual and the pleasurable and the story and the interesting theorize, and that part of how they theorize is through demanding a certain ways of thinking about the world, and perhaps now with this book of unpacking and unlocking knowledges about the world and how to be in the world. And so I don't think it's an accident that this book is so pleasurable to read, even as it does the difficult work of challenging us to think about what kind of methodologies and inspiring us to think about methodologies, research methodologies in an exciting way. And of course, it's also a daring book in the sense that, you know, even when you work on kind of gender and sexuality as an African feminist, there's constantly the negotiation of the meeting places of joy and pleasure and pain and power, because sexuality and gender are so fraught on so many levels. And also because I think any feminist working anywhere in the world is also very aware of how dangerous certain kinds of research methodologies can be if you look at sexualities. And so it's not a safe terrain, even though when we think about research methodologies, we often think, well, okay, there's a toolkit, it's a set toolkit, you know, it's established, it'll do certain work. Part of what this book talks about, shows in various exciting ways, are the ways in which this is always political work. I love the story, which I'm not going to tell because I don't want to ruin it for you, that Jane and Charmaine tell of the very many layers of what it means to be a jacketed woman. I think it's such a wonderful metaphor for thinking about African feminist theorizations and works and struggles and discoveries and pleasures on working on African, on gender and sexualities, the meeting places of, you know, so many different things. So I think that it's a fantastic metaphor. Unfortunately, some of you don't know what it is yet, but believe me, when you read that section, which I'm not going to say much more about, I think it's a fantastic, fantastic metaphor. But speaking about what this book does, And the terrain, it's incredibly evocative of the terrain that this book enters, and no doubt changes. I think also just epistemically, it's a fantastic, exciting project that invites those of us who are involved in the work of creating knowledge around sexualities. Who insist both on recognizing the painful, wounding ways in which gender and sexualities are lived, but also the exciting, inspiring, life-affirming, pleasurable ways in which the same terrain is marked, reminds us of the great responsibility, but of the enormous rewards, I think, that also comes from doing this kind of work. So I think this book is such a gift to all of us, and that it is able to do all of this groundbreaking, fantastic work, and read so well and so easily that it's very often kind of deceptively simple in what it offers. But in fact, like the Jack, the many layers and kind of interlocking meanings and competing meanings that are conjured up in that jacketed woman metaphor, and that story that Jane and Charmaine tell at the beginning, the introduction. It's a book whose importance is belied by how easily it reads. I think it's a very exciting addition to what we do as African feminists in the body or in the business of making knowledge, and a very important and necessary way to make us think again and again and again about the relationship, the tools, and the theory we use between our own bodies and the bodies of knowledge we produce and the bodies of knowledge we produce knowledge about, as well as just the everyday kind of pleasure, difficulty, joy, and trouble that enters our work, hopefully, as we participate in kind of producing and participating in knowledge on sexualities and genders in Africa. And I think that And also one other thing which I have to say, because it's a bit of a thing for me. I am so excited. You know, humanities and social science people often do this thing with this book, who refuses to do it. I'm so happy that it doesn't do it. Often do this thing outside of the arts and film studies, where we have images that occur in our books that are about some important thing that we're doing, which is very important, but where the images just kind of stand there, right? And we don't engage them, and we don't engage the fact that visual material has a visual language. This is something that this book refuses to do. And so in its multi-vocality and poly-vocality, it doesn't just do, he doesn't just kind of throw around what those words mean, but actually itself performs exactly what, you know, what it suggests theoretically. And so I'm very excited by the fact that Muzotanelemuwoli's images are engaged, and I mean, they speak for themselves, they theorize for themselves, but that in the very writing and in the very consideration and in the very crafting of the tools that Jane Shemaine and their collaborators produce, that these images themselves, you know, speak in that space and are spoken to and are part of, and I do not just stand adjacently as we so often do with covers that aren't addressed as though covers are and images are illustration. So very well done, Jane. Very excited about this book. Congratulations to you and Shemaine. And yes, I'm very excited about being able to make my students read this for research methodology rather than some of the stuff, the other things that I like but that my students complain endlessly about. But I'm also excited about reading and rereading it myself.
And I'm going to stand up because I can't, I'm in a very low seat down here.
I'm speaking. And I think that if I stand up, it's possible that I don't need the microphone. And if I'm wrong, you'll let me know. I want to do a number of things. And the first is to thank you for being here. And for coming to a book launch of a book that has a subtitle about qualitative research methodologies on its front page. And I think that that speaks very interestingly about the willingness to engage in extremely difficult questions, not simply if you happen to be trapped in the academy for 3 years or five or as a life choice, but what it means to write, what it means to imagine that the politics of representation that are about writing are part and parcel of our lives. There are a lot of stories to be told about how this collection came into being. And as I speak, I'm very well aware that I am only one voice. The work of an editor is a very privileged one, in that you get to work very closely with a number of people, including in this case Charmaine Pereira, who is not only a very dear friend but an extraordinary writer and political activist in her own in her own zones. And I wish she could be here, but I also know that I'm carrying into this space to be with you for half an hour as I speak, or less than that if you're lucky. And that a number of other people who have contributed to the book, thought about it, with whose writing we've all worked over a number of different spaces, times, workshops, emails, debates, despairs, wonders, and editorial work is very often conflated with the idea of working as a single author. They're not the same thing. I am a single author in the book, as is Charmaine, and I want to say a little bit about what I wrote and why later on. But the work of editorial collectivity is one that allows you to create a certain sort of family. I'm a person that cannot throw away a book. This is a big problem in all sorts of ways. People who've been in my office
will have recognized it, as will people who've been in my home. And one of the reasons I can't throw away a book is because they seem to me to be very like installations. That it is impossible for me to look as a book that is disembodied from the histories of the people who've written it, its circulation in the world, as I know it, and I often don't know very much about it, as it has engaged with me and my own thinking, and as it is a body whose momentary incarnation in book is simply an opportunity for circulation. So I would like to say something about this book in an invitation to include you in some of the discussions which led to its collation. And in order to do that, I'm going to behave more badly than Pumla did, and I'm actually going to tell you what the meaning of the jacketed metaphor was for those of us working with it. We do farming, and I do write about it in the introduction. In about 2009, the African Gender Institute hosted a series of residential workshops for people who were NGO activists, who were researchers, some of whom had a lot of authority as they experienced it in their zones, some of whom didn't, to talk about the politics of writing and researching. In our different contexts, they were all African, and where we took gender and sexualities very seriously. One of the women there was one of the writers in the collection. Her name is Karabo, Karabo Mokrakona. She comes from Lesotho, and she's married since the workshop, so now she has a double-barreled name in the book. And that was an argument, I can tell you. And it was an argument in her own space, in her own home, about what it meant for her to be represented in public by her first given family name, and now she was known by her husband's name. So, little stories, this book is full of stories. In the workshop, she spoke to us about how, when she was already in her 40s, she undertook doctoral research into what it meant to be teenage in the development vocabulary and pregnant in an environment in which that condition remains not a condition that spurs joy or pleasure or, well, maybe another little person, yay, but condemnation, stigmatization, and real trouble, not only for herself, but for her family, and certainly for herself in relation to staying at school, let alone anything else. Karabo had, in fact, experienced this herself as a young woman, a 17-year-old. I was once with her in Buenos Aires, and we were talking in a different kind of collective about sexuality, and she made it very clear there that the reason that she became pregnant very early on had nothing to do with lack of education or being a poor African woman or having an abusive relationship with a man. It had to do with the fact that she was dying to have sex. She thought that sex was absolutely wonderful. It was really hard to get condoms. Yes, she could have been a bit better informed about the consequences of this lovely thing that was happening between her and the relevant man, and she was delighted that she was pregnant. She was delighted. However, her own delight in what was happening to her in an embodied way was not reflected in her community, and she went through a lot of stuff in relation to that. Time went by. She continued to live where she still lives in Lesotho, and she's Catholic. She's very seriously Catholic. And in that community, there is a tradition that after having been for a while in a certain place, in a certain church, or getting older, if you are a really, really powerful, well-recognized, respected woman, you are given a jacket. A literal jacket. It's a beautiful jacket. She didn't have it with her, but she showed us pictures. And every time you go to church, you wear your jacket. It is a mark of the way in which you have embodied your best
herself. When she started doing her research, and she wanted to listen to the young women then, some nearly 25 years later, 20, I imagine, the girls treated her as a jacketed woman. They came into her space full of shame, full of apology, but they were willing to talk with her, but they wished it hadn't happened. And could she help them in relation to what the principal was saying? They came from a position of abjection, and it was a position that her jacketedness exacerbated. In that, now you can call this research methodology if you like. How do you write about it? How do you collect data in this setting? But the issue is much deeper. Of course, it relates to the meaning of creating knowledges with which we can work and fly. But her jacket became in that space the meaning why she was credible and they were not. And the questions of credibility and the ways in which differently offered jackets, jackets that I was introduced with here. Jane Bennett is the director of the School of African and Gender Studies, Linguistics and Anthropology. That's a jacket, right? It's a jacket. It has all kinds of consequences for the work that I can and cannot do as a writer. And as a writer who, yes, is in a certain space institutionally, and I don't mean in a hospital, but also has a very deep interest in why I write and what I write about. For a very long time, issues of credibility have been of deep interest to me. I don't think you can have facts. Facts are stubborn things. You don't have facts without doubt. Doubt is incredibly important. Doubt is the way in which the fluidity of argument and differential perspective is given life. But then how do we develop credibility? What is credibility? How are you believable? How are your facts believable? How are you believable? How do you engage and inhabit credibility? Now, when you look at some of the essays in the collection, it might not seem to you that they are talking about the politics of being credible, being believable. At first glance, there are papers about what it means to research the politics of widow inheritance in Kenya at a time when Kenya is exploding around so-called ethnic conflict, I mean political conflict, post-presidential stories that you'll all remember in 2008. So the title might not alert you to the fact that what is at stake is in fact the credibility of the researcher and the value of what it is that she is trying to do in order to understand what has become termed an ethnic conflict, and in fact is a debate about the meanings of gendered identities in that particular space. It will make more sense to you when you've read it. Perhaps if I draw on something I wrote myself, which is only one of the pieces, and without any nonsense, to me it's actually the least interesting, but it's the only one I want to talk about in relation to what I can be directly accountable for in the text. And the piece is an attempt to bring this question of what it means to be credible in a space where you recognize danger, the possibility of overrunning others, the possibility of grandiosity, and the possibility just of plain stupidity. The piece opens with, and now this is part of me telling you what this book is trying to do. Whether it does it, you can't don't buy it. And you've got to tell us. Because this is about inviting you into the family. We don't know. This is our idea. You buy it, you tell us what the idea is. Okay, here we start, and I'm making it concrete. The chapter starts with one of Zanele Moholi's pictures in Faces and Phases of Nopopulu Dlava, who is a priest and very out lesbian, with an extraordinary life of ministry, political engagement, working with what it means to live in seemingly completely contradictory zones. And you can say, okay, here's a jacket, right? That's a jacket. If you ever saw a jacket, that's a jacket. And it's not about, here's a picture of a lesbian. It's a picture that is radically questioning the representation of gender, credibility within the politics of a South African space. And the piece then goes on to ask questions about what it means to write as though one were believable. Very quickly, the piece moves to a story we all know very well, and in the latest discourses around gender-based violence, some of us have forgotten, so I'm going to read it to you. It's dated. It starts with a letter, which was collectively written in the very early hours of the morning of May the 9th, 2006. This is how the letter reads. Dear sister, it's not very polite to just write to someone you've never met as though you have the right to speak. So please forgive us for trying to communicate out of the blue. We are some of those who were listening to Judge Van der Merwe's words yesterday as he declared Jacob Zuma not guilty. And for the past 16 hours, we have felt outraged, nauseated, and dislocated. One thing, however, the verdict has made no difference to a fundamental fact. We believe you. We believed you when you spoke about the way in which your trust in someone you had a long, important relationship with was violated. We believed you when you were forced to speak over and over again in different languages the sentences describing what he did to you. We believed you when you spoke under intensive cross-examination about other relationships in your life and the way many of them had included abuse of your trust, your sexuality, and your spirit. We believed you when you spoke about your confusion about what to do the morning after the attack. We believed you when you explained the complexity of the decisions you took to lay a formal charge, and when you spoke about the implications of that for your life and for your family. The letter ends. There is a long line of extraordinary black, often young, South African women who have challenged structural and personal brutality with awesome passion, clarity, and individual integrity. Portia Ndwandwe, Gugu Dlamini, and Zoliswa Nkunyana are just three names that come to mind, except that they are no longer alive. You are. We who believe in freedom salute you and are holding you in our hearts and minds as the day is dawning on the 9th of May, 2006. We will not let you go. For your conviction that it was possible to speak your truth no matter what the cost, we owe you too much to explain. And the piece goes on. This was in fact forwarded to Kwesi at the time. She did respond. And the piece goes on to say, okay, what does it mean to believe? At the time, there were many ways in which that particular story was being interrogated at a number of levels. What does it take to hold fast to one person's representation of what happens under the politics of gender and sexuality, where those politics are so highly charged and so very vulnerable. The rest of the piece seeks to discuss that and returns to the idea of writing as research, writing as poetry, writing that is not writing in fact, but visual, a way of representing the possibilities of standing still and at the same time trying to move forward together. That's the idea behind the book. I don't know if we got there. Please read it. And please let us know. Thank you very much.